device company based in Northern California. In the early years of this millennium, Apriva developed a promising anti-stroke technology known by the acronym Plato, which it sold through a merger transaction to the Appley EV3. This appeal is before the court on the trial court's grant of summary judgment to Appley's on the ground that the former shareholders, my clients, relinquished their rights to assert affirmative claims against EV3 to two shareholder representatives who were identified in the merger agreement. The central issue on this appeal permits one of three resolutions. First, the first alternative is that my client's interpretation of the applicable contract, the merger agreement, is correct in that they did not intend to and did not relinquish their rights to assert affirmative claims against the appellee, including fraud claims. Second alternative is that the applicable agreements are ambiguous on that issue. The third alternative is that EV3's interpretation of the relevant agreement is the correct one, and that is that my clients did in fact relinquish their rights to assert affirmative claims. Regardless of which alternative is the correct one, my clients deserve to have their day in court. As former shareholders in Apriva, they incurred substantial monetary losses, potentially ranging in the hundreds of millions of dollars, as a result of EV3's conduct, and are aggrieved parties in the fullest sense of that expression. Again, this is true regardless of which alternative is ultimately determined to be the correct one. Under the first alternative, the trial court should have denied EV3's challenge to my client's standing outright and permitted the case to go to discovery. Under the second alternative, the correct course of action would have been for the trial court, at a minimum, to grant my clients the opportunity to present evidence in order to resolve any ambiguity that may have existed in the contract, an opportunity that they were denied. Lastly, even under the third alternative, the alternative that's proposed by the appellee in this case, the proper course of action for the trial court would have been to grant my clients a reasonable time after the determination that they lacked, that they were not the real party in interest, an opportunity to join or substitute or obtain a ratification from the real party in interest under Rule 17A of the Delaware Rules of Procedure. We respectfully submit that the only genuinely plausible determinations are either the first or the second of those alternatives. Either my client's interpretation of the contract is correct, or, at a minimum, the contract is ambiguous. If we go directly to the language, the applicable merger agreement provides that the shareholder representatives are to take only those actions that are required or permitted to be taken under the merger agreement. There is nothing in the plain language of the merger agreement that requires or permits the shareholder representatives to assert affirmative claims against EV3. The merger agreement is completely silent on this point. At a minimum, such an important authorization should have been expressed very plainly in this agreement. This could have been accomplished in a number of ways. Had the former shareholders intended to grant such broad rights, they could have easily written the agreement to say that the shareholder representatives can control all matters arising under, in connection with, or relating to this agreement.
Does the record reflect whether this is a pattern language for agreements of this kind, or you never even reached that point?
Never even reached that point, Your Honor. Never even reached that point. But such broader language, arising under, in connection with, that certainly never appears anywhere in the agreement. Such language wasn't used. Reading the merger agreement further, the only provisions that deal in any way with legal claims are provisions that are set forth in the agreement that relate specifically to the defense of indemnification claims brought by EV3 or matters arising out of the calculation of the cash shortfall or the initial per-share amount. Now, this language merits close study. Under the exclusio alterius principle of contract interpretation, the grant of such specific narrow rights should suggest that no broader rights were intended to be granted. Appellants submit that this language of the merger agreement is sufficiently clear to support a conclusion that the former shareholders did not intend to, nor did they, relinquish their rights. However, this language is, at a bare minimum, ambiguous, and the trial court should have, under those circumstances, permitted my clients to submit evidence. Now, as to what offer of proof would have been made, well, there's two species of evidence, clearly. The first would have been testimonial. Clients would have testified as to just exactly what specific powers they intended the shareholder representatives to have. Secondly, there would be evidence of the purpose of the agreement and the circumstances under which it was made.
Counsel, many of the objections or contentions that you're advancing relate to the procedural impropriety of granting summary judgment. As I understand it, the conversion to summary judgment and the summary judgment decision all took place before your client knew what was going to happen. My question is, once the decision, the trial court decision came down, was there a post-trial motion raising the issues that you're raising now?
Your Honor, there was not a post-trial motion that was brought. In light of the conversion and the finality of the order that was issued under the circumstances, we made the decision to take our appeal directly. So, you know, Your Honor, our original complaint was filed in November of 2005, and we initially received the court's order, I believe it was August of 2006. Substantial amount of time had elapsed already that we felt that the more efficient course of action was to basically take the issue straight up to appeal.
The more efficient course of action, not to preserve the arguments for appeal?
Well, we understood that they were sufficiently preserved based on the briefing that we had already done in the trial court.
Can you make that argument for us? That is, support what you just said.
I'm a little bit at a loss, Justice, as to the point. But
you said that you have, even though the argument wasn't made in a pointed way in a post-trial motion, nonetheless, it was made in some, I guess, a less than pointed way in the briefing that did take place. And my question is how.
Let me clarify. The issue, as we understand it, is a pure issue of law, and that's an issue that this court reviews de novo, the question of what the meaning of the contract is and what its interpretation. And that is what I meant by my statement that it was preserved below, that it's really this interpretive issue. That's the issue that's there. And since it's de novo review, we understand that no further motion was required to be brought under those circumstances. So I apologize if I misspoke on that point.
You mentioned there was a gap between, I think, November and the decision. The opinion attached to your opening brief says it was submitted in March and decided in June. So was there a briefing from November to March, or what was going on?
Yes. The motion was brought. We filed our opposition. A reply was brought. We requested oral argument. The court deemed it submitted without argument, and then the opinion issued thereafter, 6 or 8 weeks later, if my recollection is correct.
After the briefing was completed, the court responded within a couple of months.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Appellants respectfully submit that the court should reject the trial court's interpretation of the applicable agreement, and that's the third alternative that we outlined. That interpretation simply has no textual support. To conclude as a matter of law that a party waived such an important right as the right to sue in its own name, to control its own destiny in the course of a lawsuit, and to decide how to spend its money, essentially, without any express textual support in the agreement on which appellees rely, would be totally unprecedented. However, even under Appley's interpretation of the applicable agreement, the proper course was for the trial court to go ahead and allow my clients the procedures that are available under Rule 17A, in essence, to substitute, to join, or to get ratification from what would have been determined to be the real party in interest.
You're in your rebuttal time. Did you want to save it, or did you want to move on?
I would like to save it, Your Honor. Thank you.
May it please the Court, I am Rob Gooden, and I represent Appellant Michael Lesch, Dr. Michael Lesch, in action number 623-2006. I support the arguments which Mr. Ogloza has made with a couple of wrinkles that I think the Court ought to be aware of. First of all, as to the position that the reading of Section 15.5 of the merger agreement did not relinquish or permit the shareholder representatives to sue on behalf of other shareholders, we took the position, recognizing that it was not entirely clear, we took the position that, in fact, the agreement did authorize us to file on behalf of other shareholders. Dr. Lesch chose, because the shareholders he filed on behalf of were the other common shareholders, and all most of whom held very small interests in this company. Dr. Lesch, I believe, held approximately 85 or so percent of the common shares of the company, and he was very concerned that without clarity in the agreement, which I think Mr. Ogloza has correctly identified, the best course would be to file on behalf of those shareholders. I think, however, it's certainly true that in the relevant language, and the language is in 15.5 of the agreement, it contains the phrase any and all actions. That's what the shareholder are empowered to do. There's a very important qualifier, which was noted by the panel of this court, which heard the argument in January, and that is there's a phrase which follows another phrase, decisions, and says it's any and all actions and decisions required or permitted under the shareholder agreement. And as was pointed out in the last argument, if in fact that qualifier, required or permitted by the agreement, applies to the phrase any and all actions, the fundamental grant, I think there's very little reason to believe that that would include a suit for breach of contract and certainly not a suit for fraud. So I think one of the things we would say is that at a minimum, it should not be determined that their position is correct as a matter of law. At a minimum, it ought to be that that question is ambiguous. As I said, we read it differently from Mr. Ogloza and his law firm, but that alone, I think, establishes ambiguity. There's a second level of ambiguity that we pointed out in our briefs, and I do want to touch on, and that is what is meant by the term joint action. The court below, in dismissing our case, and our case was not converted, it was dismissed, the court observed that joint action could only mean co-plaintiffs in the same litigation. And we believe that conclusion is incorrect as a matter of law. That is, we should be allowed to put on evidence that in the circumstances of this case, where the two appointed shareholder representatives filed virtually identical actions but did them separately for a number of reasons, which I'm happy to discuss, but basically on the liability theories, they're almost identical, that they're clearly moving on the liability side and on the damages side as a whole in concert and for the same ends and for the same purposes, and that we should be allowed to establish that under the facts and circumstances of the making of this contract, that phrase should be included or should be construed to include the ability to do what was done here, that is, file separate lawsuits but with the same result sought.
Let me interrupt for a second because I have a lot of trouble with what seems to be an enormous expenditure of time and effort on behalf of two parties who all they'd have to do is join together and there would be no issue. Am I correct, first of all, that if you and counsel for the other appellants were to proceed together, this whole issue would disappear?
Yes, I believe if we filed a lawsuit where the two shareholder representatives, Mr. Vandenberg and Mr. Lesch, were proceeding as the co-plaintiffs on behalf of everybody, that would eliminate any argument at all. Although, I don't think it would eliminate the argument if Mr. Ogloza's construction of the contract is correct, namely that the shareholder, merger agreement did not empower either Mr. Lesch or Mr. Vandenberg to assert affirmative claims on behalf of anybody but themselves. If that position was accepted by this court, then it wouldn't make any difference whether they were co-plaintiffs or not co-plaintiffs.
All right. So if we assume for a moment that as co-plaintiffs this problem would disappear, then what jumps into my mind is, well, you know, why have you, instead of taking action to either attempt to consolidate the two cases yourselves or refile as co-plaintiffs, why was that not done, and instead you're up here for a second time?
Right. We're up here for the first
time. Okay, sorry.
But I understand your point. Well, as to the first, I think we have offered both Mr. Aglosa and myself have offered, and did so at the trial court level, to consolidate these actions. That's the only thing that makes any sense. But for various reasons, and they're not all ego, I did hear Your Honor's remark from the last argument about this being perhaps the product of ego. That really is not the problem. The problem is these two groups of shareholders have identical interests on liability and the size of damages, but our group represents the common and their group represents the preferred shareholders, the venture capitalists, and there are disagreements about how the proceeds of any suit would be split. And it is that disagreement which is, in my opinion, prevented the two suits from being made as a joint suit, if you will, like you suggested. So that's what's going on.
Thank you.
The final point I want to make, and then I would like to reserve any time I have left before my rebuttal time to answer any questions you may have, is that we raised the point below on rehearing that the court's rationale for dismissing our lawsuit for lack of standing did not apply to the fraud claims, and that's virtually one half of the suit. One half of the suit was for breach of the milestone payments under the contract. Second half was for fraud and the inducement. Our point there, and we think we're correct, is that if our fraud claim is proven, it will vitiate the entire contract, including, of course, the constituent parts like the shareholder representative and shareholder agent provisions. Initially, we thought, and in fact, we read Judge Scott's opinion to say that we had to elect our remedies, that is, either to sue on the contract or sue to rescind it. We pointed out that under Delaware law, that's not required at the pleading stage. He denied our rehearing, but I don't think he corrected that fundamental problem for his dismissal of our fraud claim. So that's a third point that we wanted to argue. So unless there are any questions, I'd defer.
Good morning.
Before you begin, let me just try and find out if the appellants were to join their claims in some acceptable fashion in terms of if consolidation isn't good enough, then they, you know, refile as co-plaintiffs. Would you agree that these issues would disappear or not?
Well, I certainly don't think a consolidation of their two separate actions would do it, Your Honor. But however, if they filed, hypothetically, one action jointly, seeking the same relief, then I think that solves the problem. Yes.
Well, okay.
And asserting the same consistent claims. Yes.
All right. Wouldn't you recognize, though, that in light of what was just explained about potentially divergent views as to how any proceeds should be divided, that they could bring such a claim and still maintain those as separate issues?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. They have not done that. They've brought separate claims.
I understand that. But when we were talking about the possibility that they would refile a joint action, you seem to emphasize the idea that that joint action would have to have only one consistent view of what the wrong was and what the relief should be, and that there would not be any possibility for alternatives being presented in the claim.
I believe that is right, Your Honor, and that how they divvy up...
And that would be because of the language of the agreement or because of civil procedure generally?
Well, I think because of the agreement. They are
okay
to act as a single attorney in fact, jointly. These shareholders, and it was argued in the first action by the ASLC Council, there's a battle for control, and whether it's ego or how they want to divide up these proceeds, that is their problem. When they entered this agreement, and it was the court was reminded several times in that oral argument that there were sophisticated parties, these institutional shareholders, and they agreed to the language 15.5. What they ignore is any and all actions required or permitted, including without limitation. There's not a limited set of allowed, permitted, or required actions. It's all encompassing. For example,
well, wait a second. Before we get into the language of the agreement, what if the agreement itself is invalid because it was induced by fraud?
Well, I think the most analogous situation under Delaware law would be, and it's been addressed many times, for example, absent a specific allegation that such a clause was induced by fraud, whether it's Section 16.5 or whether you take the Delaware cases that talk about arbitration clauses or forum selection clauses. Delaware courts have routinely enforced the choice of law provision, a forum selection provision, or an arbitration clauses, despite claims that an agreement was induced by fraud in its entirety. And so I think just as...
So you're saying that this provision is the equivalent of an arbitration or forum selection type clause, and that the parties have to abide by that language even if their claim is that the entire agreement is invalid?
Absolutely. I think it's analogous to the circumstances, and I point the court to the Double Z Enterprises case versus General Marketing Corp, which dealt with the validity of a forum selection clause, and then the Karish versus SI International case, which dealt with a arbitration clause. And in both of those cases, the entire agreement was attacked as being invalid by fraud in the inducement. And in those cases, the court said, well, wait a second. And if you're not attacking specifically this clause, and that's why you had, for example, a severability clause, which we have here in 16.5, and we also have 16.2 in our merger agreement, which talks about matters that can be brought. And certainly 16.2, governing law, in the second sentence says, the parties hereto irrevocably elect as the sole judicial forum for the adjudication of any matters arising under or in connection with this agreement. And so I think that would certainly address in part their fraud claim. And remember, the SRA, the shareholder representative agreement, our client, my client, EV3, and the various guarantors were not parties to that agreement. There is no way that could have been induced by fraud. And that is in that agreement, which these shareholders, again, in that agreement in Section 1, A, B through C, talk about any and all claims and the irrevocable delegation of the right to bring claims to the attorney in fact, these shareholder representatives. And so when you read the merger agreement alone independently, as both the lower courts ruled, they could do it independently on a merger agreement, but when you read them together, the merger agreement and the shareholder representative agreement, which is incorporated by reference, specific reference in the merger agreement, these shareholders did not relinquish a right to sue for fraud. They relinquished the right to sue independently and vested in and delegated to the shareholder representatives to do that for them. There's nothing prohibited under Delaware law to delegate someone else to bring your rights. And what's important is...
Well, but the delegation that you're referring to is the delegation and by inference a relinquishment of the power independently to bring in any kind of action relating to the agreement for any on any ground that may be conceived of in the universe until the end of time. I mean, isn't that essentially what you're arguing?
Well,
there is nothing left of any kind, of any description that the shareholders could bring insofar as it relates to the merger transaction.
As it relates to the merger transaction and the enforcement of the agreement, you're absolutely right, Your Honor. Well, that they independent, they gave up their independent rights.
The answer was yes.
The answer is yes, Your Honor.
Didn't the drafters of the agreement choose a rather odd way to express that? I mean, it's almost baroque. Including without limitation, and then there are very specific, narrow types of examples that are included. That is, if this were to be a universal relinquishment of everything, why didn't the agreement just clearly say that instead of going about it in the rather awkward way that it does? You're arguing that as a matter of law, the court below properly found, and we must find, that the agreement means what you now argue that it does. And I'm asking, you know, doesn't just the way it's drafted cut against that?
I disagree, Your Honor, respectfully. I don't think it's baroque, and I don't think it's in any way unclear. I think it's clear. The fact that they give one or two examples.
Many more than that.
Excuse me?
None of them of a universal kind. There is universal language used, but it isn't used in the clearest way, or at least one could rationally so argue.
I would argue, and I think both courts found clearly below and did not struggle with the language that any and all actions and the making of any decisions required or permitted to be taken by the shareholders agent under this agreement, including without limitation, in that there's any problem with that, that it's they're not arguing somehow that this is a contract of adhesion or that there is some unfair arm's length or lack of arm's length negotiations here. They have touted many times how sophisticated these institutional shareholders are. The fact is that it is any and all actions. The plain meaning of that is all-encompassing, and then including without limitation. And the fact that they, and you use the word awkward, I just respectfully disagree. I don't think it's awkward at all. I think it's all-encompassing, and that certainly the enforcement of the rights under this agreement.
You may think that, but the question is, why should we think that?
And I said respectfully, and I do believe that, as the courts below did, and I think you should think that, Your Honor, is because of the plain meaning of those words, any and all actions, and then including without limitation. For example, Your Honor, if there would have been some prohibition,
is there anything in the agreement that either requires or permits anybody, the shareholders or the representatives, to bring an action, a post-transactional contract action under the merger agreement, or a fraud action?
I think it does, Your Honor.
And where?
I think to answer your question, that as the attorney in fact with the responsibility to
It's not express, is it?
Well, I think it is, Your Honor, and I'll tell you where. It's express where it says that they will be the attorney in fact to jointly act. They have a duty to jointly act as the attorney in fact for all the shareholders. And you don't have to look far. You look at 16.2.
I'm asking you where it talks about a suit for breach of contract or fraud, and you haven't answered that.
I'm going to answer it right now. 16.2, second sentence, and I think this is also clear. The parties here to irrevocably elect as the sole judicial forum for the adjudication of any matters arising under or in connection with this agreement and consent to the exclusive jurisdiction of the federal and state courts of Delaware. Well, we're here. At least they're seeking. They're just doing it the wrong way without standing. They're seeking to enforce this agreement, and if they had done it jointly, then as the single attorney, in fact, they, in fact, would be permitted to bring this action here in the state court in Delaware. So I think that specifically is an example of where it is permitted to enforce the agreement as they are trying to do. So I hope that answers your question on that point. And so I believe it is specifically in there. And again, we go to the plain meaning of the words that are encompassed here in this agreement. And, Your Honor, they use words like ambiguity, and they use words like, well, we were not given the opportunity. Well, that's just not true. They had an opportunity. They We did file the motion, the respective motions to dismiss. One of them was converted. In fact, the ASLC group, they forced that conversion because they took the argument, for example, that the SRA was extrinsic to the merger agreement. Our point was, no, it's not. It's integral to, and it certainly was not extrinsic. Judge Herlihy took the position that you win anyway under the merger agreement. However, out of an abundance of caution, we're going to convert this to summary judgment. And you win also under the clear meaning of the SRA as it jives with the merger agreement. They should have and certainly did anticipate the ambiguity argument, because if you read the briefs on that point, they briefed it in spades. They did. They should have anticipated that it could have been converted. And what's interesting in this case, although they say that they were not given a fair opportunity, they admit in the footnote in their opening brief that it, in fact, is integral. The SRA is integral to the merger agreement. So, and they just can't have it both ways by claiming some prejudice below and that they were not given an opportunity to be heard.
Well, how are they given an opportunity to respond? In the normal motion for summary judgment, one side puts on their case and has affidavits or whatever, then the other side has a chance to respond with affidavits or evidence and demonstrate that there's a material dispute of fact. So where in the record do we see that they were on notice of the conversion and given an opportunity to come forward?
They were on notice. We filed the motion to dismiss. The defendants below appellate, we filed the motion to dismiss under 12b-6.
Right. I'm talking about once it's converted, where did they have the opportunity to say, well, if you're going to convert it to a motion for summary judgment, we have these additional items or arguments that will demonstrate summary judgment's inappropriate.
They did, that's the point. They did not do that. So when they respond to the motion to dismiss and invoke the fact that there's some that we're using extrinsic evidence, meaning the SRA, they're the one forcing that issue. They did not choose to attach an affidavit to their motion, the defense of their motion to dismiss by one of these institutional shareholders. But they argue the ambiguity. I'm sorry.
Wouldn't the normal procedure be for the court to say to them, you've got a good point, therefore, I'm going to convert this to a motion for summary judgment, and if you've got anything to add, now's your time or I'm going to make a ruling.
Judge Herlihy was faced with that. When he gets our motion for summary judgment, he then reads the reply.
No, I thought yours was a motion to dismiss.
I'm sorry. When they got our motion to dismiss, he is faced with the fact, and if you read his opinion, addresses the fact that they don't have a good point. And even if you're going to force me to, and let's assume,
well,
it's
extrinsic. Well, it looks like an alternative holding.
Well,
I understand he's ruling in the alternative. I don't think you have a good point, but if you do, I'm going to convert it and you lose anyway. But on the alternative holding, my question is, let's assume we disagree with him on whether they had a good point and that he properly converted it to summary judgment. How could he decide the converted motion without giving them an additional opportunity?
Well, the only thing they argued is that the SRA was extrinsic. And then they go on to argue that they still win under that because that gives them. So they didn't argue that they needed some discovery or some point in that response to the motion to dismiss, which you may anyway, whether it was a summary judgment or a motion to dismiss. They just argued hard on the language. Now, at some point, when it was converted, they could have sought post-trial a discovery or invoked the other rules that Rule 56, summary judgment motion, might afford you, seeking that you need some more discovery to make a point. They never once asked for it. They never once proffered or in any way made a representation that there was going to be someone out there that said, when we negotiated Section 15.5, that wasn't the intent of what the court deems that it means.
Well,
so they
I
certainly had the
opportunity. I must have misunderstood the procedure. I was under the impression they found out it had been converted when they got Judge Herlihy's decision. You're telling me they were on notice that he was going to convert it before he issued his opinion, and notwithstanding the fact, did nothing.
My argument is they
Help me understand the record. Did they know it was going to be converted before they got the opinion that said, I've converted it?
They did not know by some directive or statement from the court before the opinion was stated. My point was, Your Honor, that when they invoked the extrinsic evidence rule by saying that the SRA falls, it was not integral to the complaint and the merger agreement, they then forced that issue, and that they cannot now be heard that somehow they were caught by surprise when they're the ones that, by their very actions in calling this extrinsic, caused that to happen. And what my other point was, and what's interesting is, in the briefing here, in their opening brief, they state that it really is integral, it's not extrinsic, in a footnote in their brief. That's when I said they can't have it both ways, and that there was certainly no prejudice to them in terms of how Judge Herlihy handled things procedurally. There is
Isn't there an implicit in the argument that the contract is ambiguous is an argument that there must be, or maybe explicit, that there must be a trial, a fact-finding, and to get to that process, there has to be discovery. I mean, when you argue, how else do you get to the fact-finding without having a trial or discovery to determine what the agreement really means?
Well, because the agreement is clear on its face, and you don't need discovery.
But in terms of procedurally, if you're arguing that it's ambiguous, doesn't that, not you, the other side, isn't that also a suggestion that there needs to be discovery and a trial?
I would certainly think so in below if they had thought it was ambiguous and that is how they wanted to defend the case, they should have sought discovery on that point. They never sought discovery on the intentions of the party. They never made a motion specifically, I want discovery on the intentions of the party here, because that will create an issue of fact that cannot be resolved by a motion to dismiss or, if converted, a motion for summary judgment. They just did not do that at any point in time. And they still have never, when given the opportunity to provide an offer of proof, what that evidence would be. It's too late for that now anyway, but certainly they could have done that below. They did not do that. Thank you, Mike. Looks like my time is up.
Before you step down, I just want to, for the record, clarify. You cited to me Section 16.2. Is that correct?
That was one of the sites, Your Honor. Yeah, 16.2 of the merger agreement.
Of the merger agreement. And that's the that has the language, any matter arising under this agreement?
It does, Your Honor. And it's at A, Appendix A-102. Thank you, Your Honor.
You left with the comment that your time was up. You asked for a five-minute warning.
I misspoke. It said sum up, and now that I look down, it's not red. So
you can use your 4 minutes.
I appreciate that, Chief Justice. I'll rest, unless there's any other questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd just like to very briefly address a number of the points that counsel for Appley has made. First and foremost, the interpretation that Appley's are advancing of the merger agreement's critical phrase, any and all action required or permitted, including without limitation, renders the phrase required or permitted as pure surplusage, and it violates all the basic axiomatic principles of contract interpretation. Secondly, when challenged to show express textual support for the proposition that there was a relinquishment of the right to sue, the best that counsel could do was to point to a form selection clause, which sheds absolutely no light on that issue. Neither the shareholder representative agreement nor the merger agreement has any express textual support for the radical proposition that my clients waive their rights. On the question of why separate lawsuits, counsel for Dr. Lesh, I think, pointed out, I would just like to add costs. My clients did not intend to give a blank check to the shareholder representatives to go pursue whatever litigation they, in their own view,
was warranted. This is very much like a close corporation. There are five entities that control nearly 90%, about 86% in fact, of the economic power. These are five people. They know each other well. They know how each other operates. And my clients, wish to control their own destiny with respect to litigation. That's at bottom what's at stake here. It's not some issue of ego, anything like that. As to the motion to dismiss, the motion to dismiss that was filed by Appelese expressly disavowed any interest in conversion. And we did not argue ambiguity. We argued that the meaning of the agreements were clear. There was no relinquishment. So there simply was no notice here. I see that my time is up, so I apologize unless the court has some questions.
Very briefly, I'll address two points. One is the language of Section 15.5, and here I will support Mr. Ogloze in the sense that although we ended up reaching a different conclusion, we agonized in face with that language. Why isn't this in here? There is wordage that could be read to include the right to sue, maybe, but why isn't it here? And so on that basis, I think at a bare minimum, following up on Your Honor's points, if these sophisticated parties had clearly intended to create that power and that relinquishment, they could have done so much, much better if that's what they intended. So as I say, we reached a contrary conclusion, but it was a very difficult choice faced with, frankly, ambiguous language. The second point I'd like to address goes to fraud in the inducement. Counsel makes the point that this should be analogized to arbitration and forum selection. I've never seen that doctrine, that is, that you have to show fraud in the inducement as to the specific provisions outside of those two contexts. And I don't think it should be broadly extended to provisions like this, particularly provisions that are not absolutely expressed on their face. Normally, the forum selection clauses, arbitration clauses, are very clear that they're intended to cover all disputes arising under or related to the agreement. There's no such language here. So I don't think that exception to the general rule that fraud and inducement voids the whole contract, including all of the constituent parts. So I'm going to make those two clarification points.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Take the case under advisement for recess.